Its Current State, I'm Mark Bayshore. Plastic floating in the Great Lakes. Scientists have conducted extensive research on the plastic-filled gyres of the ocean. Those are the swirling clusters of debris that you're apt to see in any body of water. But this summer, researchers decided to look inland and measure plastic pollution in the Great Lakes. Some of the Great Lakes water samples had concentrations of plastic greater than that anywhere else in the world. The studies resulted in several other projects which focus on the sources and the effects of plastic pollution on the Great Lakes. We're joined today by the study's leader, Dr. Sherry Mason. Sherry is a chemistry professor at the State University of New York at Fredonia. Welcome to Current State.
Hi, thank you for having me.
There are a substantial number of studies by this Five Gyres Institute which detail oceanic plastic pollution, but the study you conducted last year is really the first to look inland and research plastic pollution in our Great Lakes. First, can you explain your research method and what exactly were you looking for?
So we collaborated with the Five Gyres Institute, and we were surveying the open waters. So there is one research group who has been looking at like near shore, essentially beachline studies of plastic debris, but we were the first to look within the open water of the Great Lakes. We use what's called a mantitrol, and it just kind of coasts along the surface layer of the water, and it's a giant net. And as the water runs through it, anything that's bigger than a third of a millimeter will be collected by the net. We run it for an hour at a time at 2 knots, so we go about 2 miles of sampling with each sample, and we pull it in. We take anything that's within the net, and we bring it back to the lab for more thorough analysis.
And what are some of the dangers, the immediate dangers of plastic pollution?
Well, I mean, there's the direct effect, which is simply, that if there's plastic in your water and, life relies on water, that it could make its way into the food chain. And this, again, has been bore out in kind of the oceanic studies where, you find albatross birds in the middle of the Pacific Ocean and their guts are entirely filled with plastic. Similarly with sea turtles and various sperm whales and fish and all sorts of marine life in the ocean. So we know it's an issue within the oceans. We suspect that it's probably a similar issue within the Great Lakes, but we're just kind of getting started because our research was the first to actually show that there were plastics within the Great Lakes, although it wasn't a huge surprise in many ways. 35 million people live within the Great Lakes watershed. Most of us, if not all of us, use and lose plastic. I probably every single one of your listeners can think of a moment when they've seen a plastic bag blowing in the wind. They've seen, a cigarette lighter on the side of the street. And most of us, when we see these things, we just don't really necessarily think about what happens to them. And the reality is that they make their way into our water supply. And so they can be taken in by any organism that relies on that water. We tend to look at fish and birds, because they are kind of the direct link, but certainly all of us drink water too. So the concern is that it makes its way into the food web, and for animals that rely on that water, kind of the first impact is that it can give them a cessation that they are filled. It fills up their stomachs. They no longer think that they're hungry or thirsty, and they starve or dehydrate to death as a result of taking in that plastic directly. But there's an indirect effect as well.
Let's talk about what you found in Lake Erie. One of your findings that really stands out is the amount of plastic you found in part of the water samples from Lake Erie. The number of plastic particles in the sample was 3 times greater than any sample collected anywhere else in the world, correct?
That is correct, yeah. So we sampled Lake Superior, Lake Huron, and Lake Erie. We took a total of 21 samples between those three Great Lakes, about 8 samples in each lake. So it's not an extensive study. It's the first study, and so I think it lays an important groundwork. But certainly, you know, we didn't sample, as much of the surface area as we would like, and those are, you know, kind of steps that we plan to take in future endeavors. But one, you know, a trend that was definitely kind of noticeable, and we really wanted to sample three, you know, to sample more of the Great Lakes so that we could look at how the lakes compare to one another. And we definitely saw a trend where Lake Erie, where there was an increase in plastics as you go from Lake Superior to Lake Huron to Lake Erie. Lake Erie, by far of the three lakes that we looked at, had the highest concentrations. There were two samples out of the 21 that showed extremely high concentrations, even relative to what you find in oceanic samples, and both of those were in Lake Erie.
And how much do we know, Sherry, about how all of this plastic is ending up in the Great Lakes?
Well, there's always ongoing investigations about that, but I mean the reality is it's those pieces of plastic that we see lying along the side of the road, that we see, you know, floating in the air. It's the litter in the ground. It makes its way, you know, down storm drains. Storm drains are very different than, say, like a sewage system. A sewage, you know, system goes through a wastewater treatment plant, so there's the possibility that the plastics could be removed. But storm drains don't. They typically just discharge directly into a nearby water body. And so that plastic bag that you see blowing in the wind will eventually make its way into our water supply and travel and break down into smaller and smaller pieces as it goes. One thing about plastics I think that's really important to note is that unlike many materials, they don't biodegrade. They will photodegrade, so they'll break apart, they'll get brittle, and they'll break into smaller and smaller pieces, but the integrity of the polymer molecule is maintained. So it never really goes away. So every plastic that we've ever produced, since the 1950s, is still on this planet somewhere. And what's scary is that as we're investigating this issue, whether we're talking about the oceans or the Great Lakes, is we're discovering that quite a bit of that plastic is in our water.
Very quickly, Sherry, we've got to wrap up. What are your summer research plans?
So this summer we're going back out on the lakes. We're going to be looking at Lake Erie again because it was, you know, the most concentrated of the ones that we looked at last summer.
Okay.
But I also have plans to be in the St. Lawrence Seaway and Lake Ontario, kind of the next step down from Lake Erie. We might expect to see Lake Ontario has higher concentrations than Lake Erie. And then the St. Lawrence Seaway, we're really curious how much of what we find in the Great Lakes is actually flowing out into the Atlantic Ocean.
Okay, we've got to leave it there, I'm sorry to say.
Oh, that's okay.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Dr. Sherry Mason teaches chemistry at State University of New York at Fredonia. Her research focuses on plastic pollution in the Great Lakes. Thanks again.
Thank you.
One of Mid-Michigan's greenest facilities is MSU's Surplus and Recycling Center. The center has recycled hundreds of tons of material this year. It's a place to find almost anything to reuse or repurpose: furniture, tools, office equipment, electronics, bicycles, farm implements, sports equipment, the list is endless. James Ives is Outreach and Education Coordinator at MSU Surplus. Peter Worf joined James for a tour of the facility, and they started by discussing one of the smallest reusable items.
You know, we found there's pockets around campus where they have to replace batteries, whether they're bad or not, just because of the function that they need them for. They can't afford them to die. We found a majority of them do have 90% or better, but they just still have to be replaced. And so then we're bundling them together in bundles of 12 and selling them for pennies on the dollar. You know, it's just a good way to, you know, extend the life cycle of them. You know, they can be recycled, but there's a cost to that and the cost to the university.
Well, I have four batteries for you right here that I might just leave with you because, you know, as we began this interview, I looked down at my recorder here and I saw one bar left on the battery icon, and I was worried as we went into this conversation that my batteries would die right in the middle. But when I put these batteries back in the box, there's a little juice left in them.
Sure. One bar to your recorder there might mean you know, half to three quarters of a bar for a remote control for your TV at home. So, you know, it doesn't take much power for a remote just sitting there, except when you turn it on and off. So, you know, again, there's still a lot of life left that can be used.
That makes a lot of sense. Different devices you're using with the batteries, different draws on the power. Maybe you can use a couple of what I brought in, like you said, for a remote or a backup flashlight.
Absolutely, definitely.
Can you talk about the origins of MSU Surplus?
Sure. Surplus and recycling really started back, you know, around World War II when they started collecting material for the war efforts, whether it was tires, metal, and it just kind of evolved into that. I don't know, Fred Kletke pretty much is the grandfather, the founder of salvage/surplus and recycling on campus as we know it. He just recently passed away. But it basically started back with doing what's right for the university and the community around us. And it's just hasn't stopped growing since. This facility was built about 3 years ago. It is a state-of-the-art facility. When I say state-of-the-art, it's very unique in the fact that we have a surplus store and a recycling center, a MRF, material recovery facility, all under the same roof. And working together with recycling and surplus has created some very good synergies and tremendous benefits for the university. The building itself is unique, too, in the fact that it's LEED certified gold. LEED is leadership in energy and environmental design. This building was placed with a gold. We have photovoltaic solar panels on the roof. Mm-hmm. We capture our rainwater and reuse that versus, you know, for flushing of the toilets and things like that. We use our rainwater, our roof water that comes off the roof. We have solar lighting. We have different types of asphalt out front. It's kind of good that we are green at MSU.
People in the community can come here, too. Let's say I just moved, for example, and I have about 200 corrugated cardboard boxes to break down. Is this the place to come?
It is. Yeah. However, you know, you said corrugated boxes to break down. You might want to see if somebody else in the neighborhood or somebody else that you know may be moving mm-hmm. Could use those boxes before they get recycled, again, to extend the life cycle. But, yes, we do have across the street from here, to the north side of the building, a 24-hour, 7 days a week drop-off center.
Maybe I want to go to Craigslist and just say, I have 100 really good boxes. If you're moving, here's my address. Come and get them for free.
Absolutely. Craigslist is free. It's a great opportunity.
I wanted to ask you about the amazing variety of things that are available here. Let's move to sort of the surplus or reuse area. You have everything from surplus kitchen items to hundreds of computer-related items, from laptops to desktops and everything in between. Your bicycle collection is well known.
An easier question would be to answer what sorts of things people cannot find here.
Okay.
Peter, you know, there's the saying that, you know, we've kind of always go by, we pretty much sold everything with the exception of real estate and an airplane.
Wow.
I mean, if you think of Michigan State University as a small city, you know, they have everything from the hospital, the labs, restaurants, the farms, you know, landscape services, anything and everything that a small town can no longer need, use, or want, we get and try to put it back into the community or preferably back into the university so they don't have to go out and buy something new. But it's a interesting place to be. We sold not a Zamboni, but an ice rink,
yeah.
You know, machine.
Right.
You know, and that was fun driving that across campus.
My wife was looking for a bike recently. We got a great deal on a really terrific bike. It was like new, but you have a huge variety of bikes here. And I would imagine this is one of the major attractions.
It is. You know, we recently merged with the bike project, the bike program here at MSU. So the bikes that we get throughout the year are gone through by professional bike mechanics. And you'd be surprised at what you might find. We had a gentleman who collects Schwinn Stingrays. and he found a 1969 Schwinn Stingray that had been covered up in paint. And it, you know, so it was just a good find for him. So yeah, it is a really good attraction.
With a little restoration and some elbow grease, that's a high-end bike price-wise.
Yes, I think he got it for $15 or $35. I mean, if you saw the condition of the bike,
sure.
You know, just again, with a little bit of elbow grease and a little bit of knowledge, definitely that was a collector's piece.
James, I got my eye on this green Schwinn tandem, speaking of Schwinn's, right up there in the rack there. I'm going to check that price in a minute.
Yeah, we're thinking of using that for meetings around campus. Yeah.
James, can we just walk around for 10 minutes or so and just point out some things of interest and some favorites? Let's have a quick look.
Yeah, a quick look is tough to do when, I mean, for as many items that we have.
Yeah, absolutely.
Actually, can we go to the front entrance of the store?
Oh,
because
sure.
I noticed that sometimes you put some sort of featured items towards the front door.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, we try to liven it up. We try to make it fresh, new, fun, interesting. You know, it just depends on something unique that comes in or something fun. You know, we just want to make it kind of an event for people to come shop here.
We're walking from your office towards the back of Surplus to the front door. That took about 20 minutes.
Yeah.
It's a big place.
Yeah. This is a sprayer from one of the farms. You know, a commercial sprayer, you know, that, again, has a lot of life left to it, whether it was a research project and they're done with it or it was time for them to upgrade for whatever reason. Maybe their project changed. But, yeah, it's just always something new, always something different.
Is it typical that an area farmer might come in and buy a piece of large equipment?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Typically, the farm equipment is very well maintained, used on, you know, for research. So it's not used in large areas, say maybe as a typical farm, but yet it's still the same piece of equipment that they would use on a farm, on your typical farm.
What's in the display case next door here?
Anything from antiques to tools. These dishes here were found in an attic, I believe, at the Union or the basement.
Mm-hmm.
They date back into where it says Michigan State College. I don't know if you can see that.
I can. And they're $15 each. So mm-hmm. these are real collectibles,
yes.
and they're certainly very MSU branded. And anyone close to the university might like to have these.
Oh, without, you know, they are just a very collectible piece.
Yeah. Can we walk over to this side of the store? I saw a couple of huge boxes on the way in that definitely speak to spring. James, there's got to be a couple hundred Rawlings batting helmets in front of us right now in two enormous boxes.
Yeah, well, these would have come from the softball program here on campus.
Oh, okay. These are also campus items.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
But here's a great opportunity also for maybe a little league team who needs an extra 10 helmets so everyone can have one at practice, so you don't have to. Here you go, plenty of extras.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, there's a lot of, you know, programs, whether it's high school, little league,
right.
that don't have a lot of money.
Right.
So here is a great place, you know.
A Rawlings helmet is easily $25-$30 brand new. Mm-hmm. These are going for
$8 a piece, and if you buy five or more, it's 20% off.
Beautiful. You had a couple of upright pianos here recently, but I see they're gone. So I had my eyes on those, but, you know, you snooze, you lose, right?
Yeah, but you saw the Steinway, right?
Can we go look at it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Let's go.
Have you ever played a Steinway?
Not like this one. It's a Steinway Grand, the likes of which is not made anymore or even seen very often. Do you know a little of the background of this instrument?
You know, I believe it is late 1800s.
Yeah.
It's in very good condition. It still has a lot of life left into it. You know, we've contacted the company. It's one of those that, you know, will be around for a while. It's just not everybody's looking for a Steinway. Do you play?
I play a C major chord. There it is. It's a beautiful instrument with old fluted legs. The ivory's good. No major dings or scratches.
It's a very beautiful piece.
It is a beautiful antique instrument. One of the many things available here at MSU Surplus and Recycling Center. T-
Tell us about the Community Reuse Days, James, coming up in May.
Yeah, that's where the MSU community, you know, whether a student, alumni, you currently work here on campus, you can bring in items from home that you no longer need, use, or want, and know full well that it will be handled properly. You know, we'll do what we can to try to, you know, extend the life cycle, put it back into the system, so to say. And if you have things that need to be recycled, whether it's e-waste, computers, they will be handled properly, and, you know, they won't just be thrown away. You know, whatever comes in, we do what we can to keep it out of the landfill, and that's going to be happening here in May. You know, take a look at the website, msusurplusstore.com, and you'll find information all you need there, or check us out on Facebook.
James Ives is the Education and Outreach Coordinator here. James, thanks very much for the tour.
You bet. Thanks, Peter.
For Current State, this is Peter Wharf. All things ain't what they used to be now.
Where did all the blue skies go? Just ahead on Current State, get the most by doing nothing. That's coming up with Current State contributor Scott Westerman. Plus, baseball and life in Cuba. Al Martin talks with the author of the new book, Habana Libre. That's next on Current State. Oil wasted on the oceans and upon our seas, fish full of mercury. Oh, oh, mercy, mercy me. All things ain't what they used to be. Radiation underground and in the sky. Animals and birds who live nearby are dying. Oh, mercy, mercy, mercy. All things and what they used to be. What about this overcrowded land? How much more be you from man? Can't you stand? This is Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. Scott Westerman is a longtime telecommunications executive, entrepreneur, and broadcaster. He's currently MSU Associate Vice President for Alumni Relations and Executive Director of the MSU Alumni Association. Scott's also a contributor to Current State. He recently spoke with a Big Ten business professor about getting more with less.
J. Keith Murnion is Harold Hines Jr. Distinguished Professor of Management and Organization at Northwestern's Kellogg School of Management. He's published over a half dozen books on negotiation, organizational psychology, economics, and the art and science of high-impact leadership. His latest book is entitled Do Nothing: How to Stop Overmanaging and Become a Great Leader. It's available in bookstores, on digital platforms, and in audiobook form via audible.com. Keith, thanks for joining us in Current State.
Hey, thanks, Scott. I appreciate being on.
Why are there so few really great leaders in the world?
Well, you know, I think there are a lot of really good leaders. The difficulty from getting from good to great is that people's natural tendencies get in the way. And they get in the way for a couple different reasons. Number one, evolution has really designed us to be active people. Our ancestors wouldn't have survived if they hadn't been active, and that's been passed down to us. So we, you know, the way I like to think about it, do you know how long a male lion sleeps every day?
No.
20 hours.
I would never make it on Jeopardy. 20 hours.
20 hours. Gorillas are 13.6, and chimpanzees, I'm pretty sure it's 9.7.
So they're the original do-nothing leaders then, huh?
What is our problem here, right? We are programmed to be active, and as we move up in organizations, we don't lose that programming. I mean, the other thing is we get rewarded for doing stuff. But then when we get promoted, we really need to stop doing what we've been doing, focus more on the people who are working for us, stimulate and facilitate their performance, and we'll be more effective as leaders. But too often we get in the way.
So how do you become a do-nothing leader?
Well, I think part of it is realizing that you've got some choices. And the choices start with knowing people on your team, knowing what they can do, trusting them, not being afraid to trust them, and actually realizing how wonderful the consequences are. One of the ways to do this is really scary for some leaders. It shouldn't be so scary, but take a two-week vacation. Do not bring your laptop or your cell phone. Leave things to your team for 2 weeks. See what you get when you come back. Now, most teams are not going to completely sabotage the entire organization. Instead, what you'll find is people step up, they make great decisions, they cope with problems better than you thought they ever could, and that you aren't as critical as you thought you were.
So you really start learning about the capabilities of an individual when you let
Absolutely.
Them have the wide side of the field.
You got it. And too often leaders are too nervous, too fearful, not trusting enough, and they can't get themselves to do this.
Describe the vibe at a company that embraces the do-nothing leadership culture.
Well, when leaders are doing nothing, they're really not doing literally nothing. They're facilitating other people's performance. They're acting like mini CEOs. And the main rule for a CEO is three simple words: walk the floor. Get out there, talk to people, ask them how they're doing. You want to touch base with people personally, but then ask them, what can I do to help you perform better? As I've often pointed out, people are not going to ask you for a nuclear power plant. They're going to ask you for something that actually will allow them to perform better, that may not cost too much. And son of a gun, if you can supply it, if you can facilitate their performance, you're better off, the company's better off, and the people you work with can show off their skills even more.
How important is it to know what's going on outside of work to understand what's going on in their heads inside of work?
Well, you need to know people. You don't want, you know, say in an economic downturn, which we've all experienced recently, you don't want to assign the job of coming up with a new creative strategic plan to somebody who's going through an ugly divorce, because they're going to be so distracted by their divorce, they're not going to be able to think as creatively as they might otherwise. So you do have to know people so that you can assign people jobs appropriately depending upon what's happening in their lives. But also, they need to know you care about them. One of my old students put it very well. He said, people don't care how much you know until they know how much you care about them.
That was a great line in the book. I underlined that one in my Kindle edition.
I'm glad you liked it. wasn't even mine.
Well, Zig Ziglar says you get everything you want when you help other people get everything they want.
Well, you know, part of my approach in the do-nothing leadership notion is to realize that leadership is a social activity. You can't do everything as a leader. You shouldn't do everything. You shouldn't do as much as you want to do. Let other people do it. It'll allow them to flourish. They want to show off their skills, and as a leader, you want to let them show off their skills.
You know, we live in an age where many leaders believe that it's all about shareholder value. And how can a leader effectively focus on the team concept you're talking about when the downward pressure is all about pleasing Wall Street?
Well, I'm not a big fan of quarterly reports, to say the least. I always hark back to a quote from Warren Buffett, who said, you know, the companies I buy are built like family businesses. They're not all family businesses, but they're built like family business in this regard. They're looking for the long term, not for the 3-month report that Wall Street is after over and over again. I think you have to build infrastructure. You have to build people. You have to facilitate their performance. You have to help them improve. You know, if you do things right, good things are going to happen. If you start doing the quick fix, it's going to catch up to you.
So that's what you're talking about when you're saying there's a difference between maximizing profits and maximizing value?
Part of it's that. Maximizing value, which I also wildly espouse, pays attention to the other person. So as a leader, you're going to have, I like to think of you being in teams with your supervisors, with your customers, with your suppliers, and with your own team members. And think about how they're going to react if in all of those team interactions, you're interested in maximizing value. You want what's good for your superior as well as what's good for yourself. You want what's good for your customer as well as what's good for yourself. And when people see that, they're going to be wildly attracted to you because you're not in it just for your own outcome, for your own profit. You're in it together, and you can be more creative in coming up with ideas that expand the pie so that everybody can be better off.
We're visiting with Keith Murnion, who is the author of a fascinating new leadership book, Do Nothing, How to Stop Overmanaging and Become a Great Leader. Keith, when you were in fifth grade in Sister Marie's class and she was giving you all that math homework,
exactly.
What did you want to be when you grew up?
Oh, you know, I really didn't know what I wanted to be. I can tell you that in my neighborhood, kids wanted to be policemen or firemen, and I wanted to be a little different. So I thought maybe I could be a doorman, or maybe I could be a mailman. Or, and then later in eighth grade, you know, you're graduating and they want to know what you want to be. Well, then I had higher aspirations. I thought maybe I'll be a nuclear physicist. The only reason I wanted to be a nuclear physicist was because my nickname at that time was Mr. Arithmetic, because I could add and subtract well in my head, and we didn't have calculators yet. You know, this was not a good nickname, but I'm happy that I have gotten beyond it.
And how did you finally zero in on your passion?
Well, I was really lucky to live in an apartment building. Right below an associate professor in the psychology department at Purdue University. And I made the rash move of asking if he was doing any research and needed help. And boy, was that fun. And then he actually arranged for me to be able to teach a full class on introductory psychology my senior year. I think they were short of TAs, and so they were desperate, and they hired me to do it. I was horrible. I was the worst teacher you could imagine, and I loved every second of it.
Sounds like he was teaching you by deviously releasing control.
Well, I think that's absolutely true. I had a lot of control. I thought I was great. I really wasn't, but, man, I was having a great time. And I just loved trying to figure out why people behave the way they do and how you can create social situations for everybody's benefit.
You know, and I was mentioning that the phrase deviously releasing control. You talk about that in the book. What does that mean?
Well, leaders often take too much control naturally, and it's because they're responsible for team outcomes. But that leads them to be pretty overbearing. What I suggest instead is think about ways that you can structure situations to still retain control even when you're not around. So incentives are a perfect way to structure behavior. I mean, one of my favorite examples is, you know, tell everyone on your team that you'll pay each of them $10 if when they park their car in the company parking lot, they park it facing north. What are you going to get that next month? Everybody will be facing north because people pay attention to incentives. That's a simple example.
The book is Do Nothing, How to Stop Overmanaging and Become a Great Leader, filled with wisdom that translates well to whatever role you're now playing, and a treasure trove of advice to help you move in the direction of the person you hope to become. Keith Murnion, thanks for joining us in Current State.
Take care.
For Current State, I'm Scott Westerman. Ah-hoo-ah!
Baseball and life in Cuba are the central focus of Tim Wendel's new book, Habana Libre. Wendel was a recent guest on AM 870's Current Sports with Al Martin. Tim started the conversation with Al by sharing a few baseball memories.
Oh, I think I've been a fan since a young age. Anybody who saw the movie The Natural, the last scene is at a place they filmed it. Unfortunately, it's not there anymore, in Buffalo. I grew up outside of Buffalo, and that's the old rock pile. So where Robert Redford takes that guy deep is where I saw my first game. Actually saw some games way back when I was a kid at old Tiger Stadium. Had relatives up north, up in the Traverse City area, and we'd often hit a game on the way there. So
right.
I've always loved baseball in part because of the game, but also because it can take you so many places, both historically and also, you know, kind of current events. And that's kind of one of the things that's happening with the new book, Habana Libre. I've been to Cuba three times. When I was finishing up summer of 68 about the Tigers and the Cardinals and that great World Series, I was going, boy, what are you going to do next? And I found myself thinking about those trips to Cuba again and, you know, writing something about that island and their passion for baseball also.
Now, you talk about all those memories, Tim. I mean, you've had countless memories when it concerns to the game of baseball. Which one sticks out the most to you? I know it's hard to choose.
It's hard to choose, but in some ways, and I don't know, this may allow me to plug the new book a little bit, Habana Libre, but
right.
I, you know, when I went to Cuba my first time in 1992, Al, I thought I knew everything about the game. I just covered my first couple World Series for Baseball Weekly. I was one of the founders of that publication. I thought I knew it all.
Man.
And I went to Havana, and nothing prepared me for, number one, how passionate the fans were, but how good some of the players were. That infield for the team, the national team out of Cuba back then, was stellar. And I think the guy playing third base, a guy named Omar Linares, is still potentially the best third baseman I have ever seen. He was like
Man.
A cross between Brooks Robinson and Mike Schmidt, could hit for power, could field. And so in starting up this book again, nobody knows Omar Linares because he never defected. He wasn't like the Hernandez brothers or even some of the guys coming out now that are making news, like Puig with L.A. and Hespedes
right.
with Oakland. Nobody knew about him, and that kind of became the starting point for this new project. What if he had thought more serious about coming out? What would have been the ramifications? And there's a character in Habana Libre called Omar Silva, you know, not much of a leap there, but is based in very broad strokes on the great Omar Linares.
Now, talking more about this book, Tim, Habana Libre, now you talk about, as you just said, the connection between Cuba and the United States when it comes to the game. How does your book highlight that connection?
Well, it's pretty much, I've always been amazed, Elvis, the nations are so close.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, in a lot of ways, they're connected, and yet they're separate. One of the things that blew me away, they have a place down there they call skinny caliente, which means the hot corner in Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
And it's pretty much part of their central park. It's a corner of the park. You can go there any day of the week, and there'll be hundreds of people debating baseball. I bet you they're debating right now the Tigers' lack of a closer.
Right. Very hot topic.
Very hot topic everywhere, even in Havana.
Yeah.
But one of the things that I find amazing is there's a connection, and a lot of them know baseball, at least statistically, and who's up with what roster better than I do at any given point. But what's the disconnect, what blows me away, is I often, when I go to Havana and go to Skinny Caliente, I will bring copies of, newspapers, Sports Illustrated, whatever I can get a hold of. And invariably, when I've handed those out to people, they will, like, look at them, you know, say back in the old days and go, is that what Cal Ripken really looks like? Is that what Ken Griffey Jr. really looks like? They know so much about him, yet they never see the games and they never see the images. It's so bizarre.
Unbelievable. Engine, we're talking with Tim Wendell. He is an acclaimed author, author of 10 books. His latest book entitled Habana Libre, and that's very interesting. So Skinny Caliente, that's what you call it, right? And that means what again?
It means the hot corner.
The hot corner.
And it's a place, again, they have these impassioned debates about baseball every day of the week, and it's mostly men, but there are women there, and they'll be debating, oh, they shouldn't have started so-and-so in last night's game or whatever, and
right. They're
mostly just hearing it on the radio, or box scores are getting kind of still on the black market in Cuba. You know,
a
box score is a big deal in Havana.
Wow, so they don't even see the game, but they're debating it like just going off what they hear on the radio and things they read. That's unbelievable,
right,
man. That sounds like the barbershop. We have a segment here called Barbershop Wednesday, and we just debate about, you know how you go in a barbershop and everybody's debating tons of topics. That's what Skinny Caliente is like. That's really cool, Tim.
It's very much so. I think all they need is a barber down there, and away they go.
Exactly. So, Tim, I mean, you've been around the game for years and years. In what particular ways has the game evolved over your time, and has it changed for the better?
I think it is changing for the better. It's taking some time. I think... It's funny, I can remember being with Ken Burns when he was finishing up the edits for his PBS series on baseball.
Mm-hmm.
And we were like hanging out after work. He's up in New Hampshire, you know, one night. And we were just looking at, in a sense, outtakes, things that did not make the final cut. And we were watching this old footage, I believe a game in the 50s between the Giants and the Yankees at the old Polo Grounds in New York. And it was fast. I mean, guys are going first to third, and they were throwing inside, and it was very, you know, it was aggressive. It was macho. People were fast on the base paths.
Right.
And Ken at one point said, "That's too bad. You don't see that as much in the major, you know, in baseball today." And I kind of smiled and said, "Ken, you can still see it. You have to go to like Havana, Caracas, you know, Venezuela, Panama." Because that's, in a sense, kind of what the Latinos have seized upon with baseball. And I think with the rise of Latinos within the major leagues, they're kind of bringing that old style. In a sense, they're bringing our game back to us. And I think that's a really cool thing. The exhibit I helped the Hall of Fame with up in Cooperstown, at one point we decided just to kind of have footage, boom, 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 real quick, of all these kind of great plays. And invariably, a lot of them were Latino stars, you know, making barehanded throw to first base or some diving catch or something like that.
Right.
So this passion, this aggression for the game, I think, is what is coming back to our national pastime.
Very true. Now, Tim, you just hit on it. When you look at the growing popularity of the game of baseball, when it comes to the Latino population, I mean, it's mind blowing. I mean, look at the Detroit Tigers right now. They have about 10 players from places like Venezuela, Cuba, the DR, the Dominican Republic. I mean, when did this trend for, you know, as far as popularity in the Latino culture, when did that start?
It started actually longer ago than people think. They've been playing baseball in Cuba almost as long as they've been playing it in this country. It's close to 100 years. But it's a little bit different. It's viewed differently on a couple different levels. Number one, at least in Cuba, it was always the game of an independent nation. You know, if you were kind of a radical who wanted to break away from Spain back in the day, you played baseball. You didn't go to bullfights or play polo or do these other things.
Right.
You played baseball. It was like this radical game. And I think the other thing that's really kind of allowed it to take off in the Caribbean is it's a game that's still in a lot of these nations, Cuba, the DR, certainly now Venezuela has taken off. It's a game that's handed down generation to generation, a little bit like it used to be in this country. And as I've been told in my travels a lot around the Caribbean, I've been reminded of, teaching a kid baseball is difficult. You know, you need an adult there. You need somebody to kind of guide them through because it's, number one, it's a tough game to learn, and it's a game you don't learn by yourself. It's not like you're going to take a basketball and go down and shoot hoops.
Right, exactly.
And so I think that type of, you know, organization or mechanism still exists in a lot of these maybe even poorer parts of the Caribbean, and that's one reason that a lot of these towns like, you know, San Pedro de Macorís and the Dominican Republic is like the place of shortstops. That's what they love, in large part because the whole community and a lot of families have embraced that.
Definitely. Well, there you have it. Acclaimed author who also serves as an exhibit advisor to the National Baseball Hall of Fame. He has written 10 books. His latest one called Habana Libre and talks about the interesting connection between Cuba and American baseball. Tim Wendell, thanks a lot.
Hey, my pleasure, Al.
That's Current State. Our engineer is Aaron Young. Joe Lindstroth produces the program. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for listening to Current State.